December 12, 2012, Mayapur, India, Nectar of Devotion, Class 17.
Okay, you guys are writing better and better questions. So for chapter 12, I want to go just to one thing, and then we're going to do the Panchanga Bhakti in 12 and 13. And that's just on page 103. Serving the Lord according to our position. So if I have more, I offer more. We talked about this the other day also. You know, that you don't just give Krishna a leaf. You build yourself a mansion, and Krishna has one little shelf down in the basement. So that if you don't have much, then that's fine to offer Krishna just whatever you have. But if you have a lot, you should be offering more. Okay, I also want to look on page 106 in relation to the Association of Pure Devotees. In the paragraph that starts in the Hari Bhakti Sudodaya, it's really interesting, and we hear we have a quote from Hiranyakashipu. Yeah. Don't you think that was funny?
Yes.
So here it says that association acts like a crystal stone that reflects whatever is put in front of it. So Prabhupada says if we associate with flower-like devotees and our hearts are crystal clear, then we will reflect them. So it's not just the association, but it's also our having a clear heart. So we'll benefit from that association. Because after all, I mean, there are demons who associate with devotees and just try to kill them or whatever. You know, it's not just the association with devotees, but it's associated. Just like Prabhupada gives the example that the man has to be potent. Both man and woman have to have potency. If you sow a seed in the ground, right? So the listeners and the hearers, I mean, as a teacher, I sometimes get audiences that are just like, I don't know, part of the wall. And then it's very hard to do anything. So it is true that we pick up on our association, but we'll pick up on our association more, depending on how much our hearts are like a crystal stone. Okay, we all prepared to be Dayabak and inherit the kingdom of God?
Yeah.
Everybody prepared for Dayabak?
Do you want to keep me in the corner board? That's all right. Okay, so now we have but you can have a triple D, HB. Devotees, DD's Dham, Hari Nam, and Bhagavatam. Or whatever you want to do. You might think of a better one than that. And then we have such a nice quote. On page 109, if you could turn to page 109. Rupa Goswami has stated that five kinds of devotional activities, namely residing in Mathura, worshipping the deity of the Lord, reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, serving the devotee, and chanting the Hare Krishna mantra are, can we read this together? So potent that a small attachment for any one of these five items can arouse devotional ecstasy even in a yoga. Sound pretty good, everybody?
You like that?
Yeah.
What do you have to have? Just a
small attachment.
And then it can arouse
devotional
ecstasy. Look at that. Isn't that cool? So these are called the five most potent devotees, deities, dham, hari nam, bhagavatam. The five most potent. We had another list of the 64 of the most something.
The three most important positives.
And then we had another list of the
ten negatives.
What were our 10 most important positives? They were the first three. We saw those great bona fide and bogus spiritual masters yesterday.
So remember those three most important. They all have to do with
the spiritual
master. And the first one was
taking shelter.
Okay. And the next one was
becoming initiated.
Inquiring and hearing, right? Getting instructions. Okay. And the other one was? So you take shelter, you take initiation, you heard instructions, and then you? You're doing what you're doing now. You're doing the?
It's initiation.
So you take shelter, you take initiation, you hear what you're supposed to do, and then you do it. So that's the most important. So we have to distinguish between the most important, the three most important, and the five most potent. Anyone have any ideas? What is our difference here between important and potent? Yes?
Potent means having the capacity to purify, a strong capacity to purify, and important means absolutely necessary for...
Did everybody hear that?
Yes.
So potent is the capacity to purify. How much capacity do these have to purify? Can anybody tell me what it says here? We just read without reading. Anybody tell me from that way? Even a
small attachment
for any
one
can arouse
a
neophyte. Whoa. Okay, so that's how potent they are. Now, of course, your guru has to be a devotee. Right? So your guru isn't here. And what does your guru give you at the time of initiation?
Harinam.
Gives you harinam.
Gives something else too. What is that?
And if you, how do you know it's a bona fide guru? On the basis of the
bhagavatam.
And your guru engages you in
deity
worship and going to a holy place or creating a holy place. And so they're not exactly separate, but of all the things that the guru engages you in, of all the things we're doing, these are the most potent. But without this, you can't get anywhere. I mean, how do you know what to do? If somebody says, I'm just going to do it myself. So therefore, it's the most important. If you don't have this, you can't do anything. You're lost. I mean, you can do something. You can look at the world and say, there must be a God. I do a little exercise like this sometimes with people, where we go through just logic and reason, why there must be a God and what he must be like. So there must be a God, he must be very orderly, he must be very creative, he must like a lot of variety, he must like surprises, it's got to be one and not a committee. Figure things like that out, just with logic and reason. But we can't get really past that unless we have a spiritual master, unless we can guide. So anything else, even, you know, what is pure bhakti? What is the goal of life? Who is God? Without taking shelter of a guru and getting instructions and actually making that firm commitment and then following those instructions, you can't get anywhere. But of all the instructions that we got, these are all the 64 angas of bhakti. If you say, oh, 64 angas, I don't know if I can do all of them. I don't know if I can worship banyan trees, and I don't know if I can... Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
What about the gopis who didn't take shelter of particular spiritual master? Because some, for example, I have a friend who was aspiring for particular spiritual masters, even two or three, but they all kind of fell down, and... Now he's not initiated, but he's serving nicely. He's really good at devotee. So what is his position?
Well, what did Prabhupada say? Until initiation, the relationship with Krishna is not firmly established. So, you know, I know some people who are engaged to be married for 15 years. Of course, nowadays, people without being married live together and have five kids, etc. But the rate of split up is higher among people who never marry than people who marry. So, but I do know people who've been engaged for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Don't you know now? Modern society, this is not uncommon. But it's not the same. You know, you can be engaged for 8 years, but you're not married. Of course, nowadays, maybe marriage doesn't mean anything either, but I think you understand what the difference is. So what's their position? You know, if you're not married, you're not married. If you're not enrolled, you're not enrolled. So, like, I'm sure there are some people who come to these classes, you know, for years, and they just never actually enroll and never get a certificate, right? Sometimes people are coming for 5 years, 10 years. Actually, I had a friend who did that with universities, was constantly going from one university to another, taking this class, but they never got a degree. So at a certain point, we have to make a commitment. Initiation is making a commitment. So we're not going to spend much time on it, but at the very end of chapter 19, Srila Prabhupada gives Rupa Goswami's progress of bhakti from Shraddha to Prema. And as I said, we're not going to spend much time on that in this class. That's, if you really want to get into that, you'd have to look at Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's Madhurya Kadambini. But Vajana Kriya is the place at which initiation takes place. So you can make a certain amount of progress. Now sometimes... And somehow I can't find the page. Sometimes you can get full Krishna consciousness without doing practically anything. And that's compared to getting an honorary degree. And it happens sometimes. Like my godbrother Judhakarma is in that category. Actually, Judhakarma is a very extraordinary person. Any of you know Judhakarma? You know him? No? So I don't think he ever finished college. He's a brilliant man. He was working with Sataputta Prabhu, who left his body a few years ago. And Sataputta had a PhD in mathematics from Cornell University. Another very brilliant man. And although his doctorate was in mathematics, he also studied a lot of astronomy and physics and other things. And he was one of the people that Srila Prabhupada really encouraged to preach to the scientists and to preach against a lot of modern scientific fallacies. So Sataputta Prabhu wrote many, many books and articles while he was with us, before he left his body. And Judhakarma Prabhu for many years was his assistant. So they co-authored a book called Forbidden Archaeology, which you might have heard of. So that was co-authored by Richard Thompson, who's Sataputta, and by Judhakarma. And Sataputta, he would give some talks and do some travel, but he was really a very retiring kind of person. He wasn't the kind of person that liked to go all over the world and... It just wasn't so much into that. And at one point, Judhakarma and Sataputta parted ways, unfortunately not very happily so.
And Jhudakarma started doing extensive traveling and preaching on the basis of the fact that he was the co-author of this book. Now, he didn't even have an undergraduate degree. Sariputta had the PhD. But just because he authored a book with somebody who had a PhD, he would be invited to speak in scientific circles, which is very astonishing, by the way. Generally, at scientific meetings, they don't ask you to speak unless you are a scientist. They would expect you to have a PhD and maybe working for a university and publishing things, all kinds of things. And he would get to speak and present papers. He's had articles published in scientific journals. That's nothing short of incredible. Now, he's actually qualified by virtue of his research. And he presents a Krishna conscious point of view also. And he's very open that he's a devotee. He's very, very open. I mean, he doesn't go in a dhoti. He goes in a suit and a tie. But he's very open that he's a devotee. He's very open that he's presenting the Vedic point of view. And he does also get on a lot of what I would call alternative places. He's often on, I forget the name of it. There's a radio show that's like alternative thinking. But he does go to a lot of mainstream scientific conferences and get in mainstream journals, etc. And he is treated, not maybe 100%, but pretty close, as if he were a scientist. People do not deal with him as if he's not qualified. And I think a couple years back, he got an honorary PhD from some university in Europe. So it does sometimes happen that a person without initiation or without, you know, following the rules and regulations, somehow becomes qualified by an alternate route. But generally, we don't plan on that. I remember when I was thinking about going back to school, and I asked a number of devotees, should I get a graduate degree? And about 70% of them said yes, about 30% of them said no. And Jhudakarma was one of the ones who said no. He said, why bother? He said, you can get the same thing by writing a book. Because that was his experience. And I thought, okay, well, to get my degree is going to take 3 years. To write a book is going to take at least 3 years. And I thought, if I get the degree, that's more of a sure thing. I thought, who knows if A, I'll ever write the book, B, if it'll ever be accepted, and etc. Jai Gauri Maharaj is now writing this book on a Krishna conscious view of one of the books of the Bible, which I'm reviewing. And in his introduction, he says, this is not a doctoral thesis. And I was talking to him the other day, and I said, you know, Maharaj, it could have been. I said, really, this book that you've written could easily be a doctoral thesis. Now, he's not interested in getting an honorary degree, as far as I know. But he could, actually, for that book, if he just would have to structure it a little differently. But we don't generally plan on that. I thought, when Jhudakarma gave me that advice, I thought, well, I don't want to plan on getting an honorary degree. I thought, if I'm going to put in all that work, I might as well just do it the regular way. Because that's certain. So I could be wrong. I don't believe Jhudakarma Prabhu exactly planned for his life to go that way. I really don't think so. I think it just sort of happened. And there he was. So sometimes it may happen that a person circumstantially, for whatever reason, ends up going an alternate route. But we shouldn't plan on that. We shouldn't say, well, I'm going to go an alternate route. We should plan on following that. That way is sure. And we can say as a principle that without initiation the connection is not established. Exactly like you can say without actually getting married, you're not married. You don't have the connection's not there. Although there's some connection before marriage. And that's, I think, about the best that I can do for you. You know, Krishna is a person, he's independent, he can do whatever he wants, he can bestow Krishna consciousness on whatever he wants, he's not bound by these things. But generally, unless we make a commitment to Krishna, he doesn't make a commitment back. Krishna is the head of the university. And unless you officially enroll in his university of bhakti, you're not likely to get a diploma. It's just pretty simple. And you might. It's possible. Some do. Definitely some do. But it's unusual. You know, it's for some people, like with Judd Bharat in the Bhagavatam, he was initiated in his previous life. In his life as Judd Bharat, he didn't even cooperate with his father trying to teach him anything. But he remembered his previous life when he'd been initiated. So that's also an unusual circumstance.
you know, Sukadeva Goswami didn't undergo any of the reformatory processes, and he's our main speaker of the Bhagavatam. So he just had his father Vyasadeva as a Shiksha Guru. He never officially took Diksha. So that may be, but that's unusual. You shouldn't plan on that. You shouldn't say, I'm going to plan to be like Sukadeva Goswami. You know, if you want to preach to the scientific community, it'd be far better to get your degree than to hope to go the path that Judah Karma Prabhu is on. That's going to be unusual. Or I'd say some other unusual cases I know is my godbrother Garuda. So Garuda dropped out of secondary school as a failing student. And then he got a music scholarship to college. So he got into college without having a secondary degree. He ended up getting 3 master's degrees and a PhD from Harvard, and he's a college professor. But somehow he skipped getting a secondary diploma. And on the basis of his music, he got into a college. But that's unusual. You wouldn't say to your children, oh, don't bother getting your secondary diploma. You can get into a college anyway. I mean, actually, that happened to me, too. Should I tell you my story, too?
Yes.
So I dropped out of college to join the Hare Krishna movement. That was kind of the in thing to do in those days. Drop everything. You know, Bir Krishna Swami dropped out of college with 1 semester to go. Shiva Ramaraj dropped out with 2 weeks to go. He said his mother almost ended up in a lunatic asylum. When he did that. Well, our preaching then was, you know, you might die now. And we interpreted not having karma covered bhakti as don't do anything in the material world. That was our interpretation of karma and avartam. So yeah, I felt I wanted to wait till I was 18. I wasn't a surrender to Sachin Andan Maharaj, who convinced the devotees that they should accept him at, I think, 16. I mean, I stayed in the temple at 17 without my parents knowing about it. Now most temples won't even let you do that. But anyway, I stayed when I was 17, and then I went back to school and I finished the year. I thought my parents have paid for the year. I shouldn't leave in the middle and I should wait till I'm 18. But then I dropped out of school at the end of 1 year, which my mother was really, really, really upset about. And then I became a Gurukul teacher. And when I became a Gurukul teacher, that was the days when they said, you don't need any material qualification. As long as you're chanting 16 rounds and going to Mangalarti, you can do anything. I'm not quite sure what shastra they got that from, yeah. So, at that point, we considered karma-covered bhakti, again, to do anything out in anything that had anything in the world. So if you went and took a course in the world, you know, oh, that's not pure devotional service. That was how we understood it at that time. Now I think we've kind of gone way in the other direction. So immediately I thought, I've got to take some courses. I've got to learn how to teach. But I had to do it kind of quietly. Yeah, I couldn't advertise. Can you imagine? So I'm running a school and I can't tell people that I'm taking professional training because then they'll think I'm not qualified. Weird. Just see how culture changes, you know. Anyway, so I took a lot of professional training courses. And then the government was requiring me at one point to finish my degree. But at that point, I know, I was running a school already then. So I was full-time teaching, running a school. I had little kids at home. I was going to the whole morning program with, you know, 20 kids. And so when was I going to have time to go and get my degree? So I did a thing through independent study where they said they'd give me credit for what I did as a devotee. So bless you. So in 1 year, while going to the whole morning program and while teaching full-time and while running a school full-time and while being a mother and wife and cleaning my house and cooking, by the way, I did 1 year of school through independent study. And they had told me they were going to give me full credit for my Gurukul work and give me a teacher certification. And I paid $1,000, which in those days was probably worth $5,000 today, to make a video and do all this stuff to meet their requirement. And then the head of the department changed, and the new head of the department said, I'm not going to do that. So I quit. But I still wasn't in compliance with the government rules, so it was a little funny. And then again, I thought, I really have to do this. I've really got to get this done. So again, I found a school who would let me do things through independent study. And they said, we'll give you credit for life experience. But you have to document it. I had to go through it took me 5 weeks to document it.
5 weeks full time, like 40 hours a week, to get basically 2 years of college. I mean, it took a year and a half between the time I enrolled and the time I actually got the diploma, but I only had to work for 5 weeks. And I had to just prove that what I've done in Krishna consciousness was equal to their courses. So then I finally got a bachelor's degree. So, okay. Had a bachelor's degree in education and religion, okay. And then, you know, still I'm running this school. And when I would travel, people would often introduce me as the leading educator in ISKCON. And I remember it was in India, in Mumbai actually, and a devotee comes up to me before, as happens a lot, and says, I need to introduce you, tell me something about yourself. And then he said, what's your degree in? And I said, well, I just had a bachelor's. And he looked at me and said, what's that? And when I was considering going on in my education, and as I said, people gave me different advice, so the advice that really affected me was, so what happens when you speak on education, this devotee friend said, do people assume you have a master's or PhD? I said, yeah, all the time. They all come up to me, so what's your master's in? What's your PhD in? Well, you don't have one. And the devotee said, well, then they probably feel cheated. Because I'd always thought, oh, they probably think, oh, I'm just so brilliant that I have that without the qualms. Uh-huh. And my friend said, no, it's not how they're thinking at all. They're thinking, here you are put forward as, you know, like the leading doctor, and you don't have a medical degree. Then they're going to think you're a cheater. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's not very good. I thought, it doesn't look good for Prabhupada, it doesn't look good for ISKCON, if people are going to introduce me like that, and then I don't, you know, I don't really have anything. So I went to Krishna, and I said, okay, Krishna, you know, but look, I'm not going to use this degree to make money, so I can't go into debt. I can't take a student loan because I won't have any way to pay it back. And I don't have the money to pay for this, so you're going to have to give it to me for free somehow or other if you want me to do this. So that was what was arranged, and I got into a master's program. So 2 months into the master's program, I was in a class that had mixed master's and PhD students. And I was meeting with the professor of that class, who was also the head of the School of Education, about some independent study I wanted to do. And he said, what are your plans? So I pulled out my plan. I had this whole plan, 8-point plan, how I was going to reform education all over the world in the Hare Krishna movement. And how I was going to, you know, 8 points. Teacher training, curriculum, parent training, school establishment, school support, research center funding, anyway. So I put up this whole plan, and he said, well, you know, this is a great plan. You should write your dissertation on this. I said, well, I'm not in the PhD program. And he looked at me and said, you're not? I said, no, I'm only in the master's program. Remember, he was my professor. And he said, well, you should be in the PhD program. He said, we have a meeting coming up next week, and I'll submit to the other professors to put you in the PhD program. And that's basically how it happened. You know, I walked out of that meeting thinking, do I want to do that? And I remember I went to the class, and he said, okay, here's your exam papers. He said, now I graded them one way for the master's students and one way for the PhD students. I graded the PhD students by a harder scale. And I thought, oh no, he thought I was a PhD student. Oh my God, you know, he's grading me by a harder scale. I'm not going to do very well. And he said, who do you think did the best in the class? And everybody looked at me and said, and I thought, oh my God. He said, yeah, you're right. And I said, okay, I said, okay, Krishna, you know, that's pretty clear. And then I went to the professor afterward. I said, okay, I'll do it. How do I do it? He said, I don't know. We've never done this for anybody before in the department. He said, you'll have to ask at the office. So I went to the office and I said, how do I apply to bump up to the PhD program? He said, I don't know, we've never done that for anybody before. He said, why don't you just write a letter? So we wrote a letter and it went to the meeting, and because the person who wanted me to do it was the head of the whole department, it got approved. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, I just added a year in dissertation to my education. And then I remember some of my courses weren't PhD courses, because I was now doing a combined master's and PhD, and some of them, all of a sudden, two of the courses I was taking wouldn't count anymore. But I needed two electives, so I said, can I get these two courses somehow counted as my electives?
And one of the professors was really nasty and said, oh, that would break all the rules. He was one of those real rule people. You know, and she said, now we can't do that. That's against the rules. Now she's in charge of the department. And I asked my advisor what to do. He said, write a letter, make your argument. So I did. And said, we'll present it next week at the faculty meeting. And next week she was away in Africa at some conference. So they passed it. So I saw that that happens sometimes. You know, and then all the other students, of course, I tried not to tell them so they wouldn't be envious. But pretty soon everybody found out, of course. And then everybody started requesting if they could bump up, and then they closed the little loophole in their rules that had allowed me to do it. They rewrote their rules. But that can happen. But I didn't go to school with the idea that was going to happen. I didn't think I'm going to go to school and I'm going to do so well in the master's program that the head of the school is going to come to me and say, hey, come up to the PhD program. It just happened. You know, I was figuring, okay, I'm going to have to get the master's, and that's going to take me several years, and maybe I'll get the PhD, and that will take me many more years. And Krishna just opened all the doors. You know, I didn't really have to do anything. I just sort of had to say, okay, now where are we going? You know, so that may happen. That may happen, that one may get an honorary degree, that one may get some facility that's not usually the way it's done, that the rules get broken and you go through some other door. But you don't plan for that. You don't say, well, I'm going to plan my education. You know, so you don't plan your Krishna consciousness thinking, well, I'm just not going to get initiated. I'm just not going to get initiated. I'm going to hang on as an eternal bhakta and everything's going to work out anyway. That's not very intelligent. All right, let's go through each of these. And our Mandali is going to be really happy today because we get to talk about her favorite topic.
Yes.
We'll start with that. Oh, come on. What's Mandali's favorite topic?
Serving the devotees.
Serving the devotees. So Mandali, why don't you tell us about the glories of serving the devotees? Chaitanya Charitamrita, three very powerful substances that are associated with serving devotees. Yes?
It's the dust of the devotees' lotus feet.
Uh-huh, the dust of the devotees' lotus feet. Yeah, the water from bathing the devotees' feet.
And the remnants.
Food remnants. One time when Prabhupada was sitting taking prasad with the devotees, Sanat Krishnaraj was sitting next to a devotee, I think his name was Jai Gopal, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj did the kind of thing that Madhu Mangal does when he meets with Krishna in the coward voice. He said, oh, look at that over there. And then he took the galabjaman from Jai Gopal. He ate it. And when Jai Gopal turned around and saw that Tamal Krishna Maharaj was eating his galabjaman, he got really mad. And Prabhupada was right there. And he starts fighting with Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And Prabhupada was laughing. He said, today Tamal Krishna hasn't made much advance. So we should always be serving so powerful to serve the devotees. So powerful to serve the devotees. Now you might think, oh, but this just applies to the Mahabhagavata devotees. So one day, this story is very applicable to our modern times, with our modern blended families. So one day there was a little boy, 5 years old, and he had a mother and a stepmother. Now, of course, in those days, you didn't have mothers and stepmothers one after another. You had them at the same time. Today, we have serial polygamy, and then they had concurrent polygamy. So he had both his mother and his stepmother at the same time. But his mother was not very much favored by his father. His father was in love with his stepmother. And one day this little boy saw his father with his stepmother and his stepbrother, and he wanted to go sit on his father's lap, and his stepmother said, "You can't sit on your father's lap because you're not my son." And the father didn't say anything. Isn't that awful when somebody insults you and someone else is around who ought to stand up for you and they don't? They're just silent.
Expectations.
There you go. Expecting that the jiva is going to be
Krishna.
Right? So Dhruva's heart was just burning. Just absolutely burning. Why can't I sit on my daddy's lap? Why can't I get my daddy's love? And then she said, "You can't sit on his lap and you will never be the king." She said, "You have to worship Lord Vishnu and die." Can you imagine this from your mother? When you're 5 years old? "You will have to worship Lord Vishnu and die and be born as my son." That's called really nasty. That was really, really awful. And any of you have, you know, families like that, you know, there's usually a lot of pain with these sort of mixed up things. So then Dhruva, of course, went to his own mother, who said, "Your stepmother gave you good advice, you should worship Lord Vishnu," and he went to worship Lord Vishnu and so on. And when he saw the Lord said, "Because you had a desire for vengeance in your heart when you started this worship of me, therefore your brother will be killed by Yakshas, and your mother, in searching for your stepmother, in searching for your brother, will die in a forest fire." And Prabhupada says in that purport that if you serve a devotee without knowledge, you will get the result. And if you offend a devotee without knowledge, he said, you do not know where you are going. Which, of course, is what we sing every morning, Yasya Prasada Bhagavat Prasada, Yasya Prasada Nagati Katopi. Nagati, you don't get the destination. Now, of course, when Dhruva came back to the city, his stepmother, by the way, never apologized. She said, "Dhruva, long may you live," but she never apologized. She never tried to rectify her offense. There's something about this story, if you can remember why I brought this up in the first place, that really interests me. Anybody have any guess why I told this story?
You shouldn't have that feeling. But when the Lord said they will be, both of them will be died, so he felt like, sorry, why I
He was felt it. Very sorry, yes. But what was my point in bringing it up?
Because that mother didn't recognize his future becoming...
Exactly. Now, at the time that the stepmother offended Dhruva, was he in pure bhakti?
No.
What was he doing?
Mixed.
It was mixed devotional service. Mixed with what? Karma. It was karma mishra bhakti, karma covered bhakti. It was not pure bhakti. So he wasn't even a neophyte in Uttam Bhakti. He was a neophyte devotee, just like Prabhupada said, those who offer the results of Ranashram are also devotees. So he could be called a neophyte devotee, but he wasn't even, and even started pure devotional service when she offended him. And because he became a pure devotee. So think about that. Another really interesting story. This is also one of my favorites. So, Gajendra, who's our other example that Rupa Goswami gives of the mixed devotee, and he was mixed with? So how was he mixed? It was really a desire for liberation. Now, he didn't think I have to get purified first, but he wasn't Anyabhilasitasunya, neither was Dhruva. Dhruva wasn't Anyabhilasitasunya, neither anymore. So Gajendra was wanting liberation. He was wanting freedom from distress. And he's an elephant body. He didn't even have a very nice body. Talk about low birth. It wasn't just that he was white or that he was female or a white female. He was an animal. So he's being attacked by this crocodile. Now when Lord Vishnu comes and he liberates Gajendra and gives him a Vaikuntha body, what else does he do?
He kills.
He kills the crocodile, and what happens to the crocodile?
Liberation.
He also got liberation. Now, of course, he didn't immediately get a Vaikuntha body. His immediate body was a demigod body, but he was given liberation and ultimately pure devotional service. Does anyone know why? Yeah! Prabhupada says in one lecture that the reason that the crocodile got ultimately pure devotional service is he was touching the feet of a Vaishnava. And everybody was laughing at Prabhupada's class when he said that.
Isn't it that because Vishnu killed him? So
no, it's Prabhupada said because he was touching the feet of Vaishnava. So what's interesting about that is two things. What kind of Vaishnava was Gajendra until the last moment? He was mixed. He was mixed. He was not in pure bhakti. He was going to Krishna for a motive, like Dhruva was going to Krishna for a motive. He was not a pure Vaishnava. He was not in pure devotional service. He became in pure devotional service at the end. And the crocodile wasn't like offering flowers to Gajendra's foot. He was trying to eat it. So please don't try to make advancement by eating the feet of the devotee. But of course, there's that nice verse from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sadhu Sangha, Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Shastra Koi, Lava Matra Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Siddhi Hoy. And if any of you are Bengali, I really apologize for what I just did to your language. So, that all the Shastras say, Sarva Shastra Koi, all the Shastras say, Lava Matra, that's an 11th of a second. All you need is an 11th of a second association with a great soul. And then you can get all perfection. So how powerful is that?
11th of a second.
11th of a second. Why don't we take 2 minutes and turn to your neighbor and think of as many reasons as possible that association with devotees give such great benefits. Just turn to your neighbor, just two people, you'll have to go over there or something, and think of as many reasons as possible. Okay? Just one.
Just so we get to hear the pastimes of the love which lets us remember
Krishna. Light a fire, bhakti in our heart. Good, yes. Just give us one.
Okay, it's pleasing to Guru and Krishna.
Pleasing to Guru and Krishna, yes. Give us one.
You get purified?
You get purified, yes. Give us one.
They already said all.
Oh, come on. There's more than that. Give us one.
Improve our devotion life.
Improve our devotion.
Develop Vaishnava qualities.
Oh, develop Vaishnava qualities.
Remembering more Krishna.
Remembering Krishna more.
We get strength and continuing our Krishna consciousness.
We get
render service.
Are you in there? Okay, yes?
Makes you humble.
Makes you humble. Whoa. Yeah, okay.
Yes, get dust from a pure devotee's
feet
and become pure devotee.
Oh, from the dust from a pure devotee's feet and you become a pure devotee. Yes?
Okay. They reflect Krishna in their hearts.
They reflect Krishna in their heart. Yes?
They're kind.
They're kind.
Supportive.
What? Yes?
Non-judgmental and supportive.
Non-judgmental and supportive. Very, very nice. Okay, let's go on. And one thing I'm going to say about initiation regarding deities and Harinam. So, Bhakti Vinod. Thanks. Bhakti Vinod Thakur talks about the five elements of Diksha, the five parts to Diksha, and that is Tila, Nam, Tapa, Mantra, and Archana.
Now, what Srila Prabhupada did was he gave these at first initiation and everything at second. And nama can mean either giving the holy name or giving you your name. And what is our tapasya?
For the principles.
The South Indians, their tapasya is they brand you on your arm.
Yeah.
Actually, it's interesting. Just recently in Vrindavan, I met an Australian couple in Govindas who were wearing Sri Vaishnava Tilak. And it was very interesting because you don't see very many non-Indians wearing Sri Vaishnava Tilak. And they were saying they're actually initiated in the Sri Vaishnava Sampradaya, and they showed me their brands.
It happens in my Sampradaya.
Mm. Isn't it nice? The Prabhupada didn't ask us to do that. So when we do the three most important items of devotional service, especially when we take... I'm really glad you're enthusiastic, but there's no mic. There's no mic. I'm really glad you're enthusiastic, but there's no mic. And so if you're... They have to talk because they're translating, but if you're talking, then I have to talk over you and I have to strain my voice, and then I'll make you buy me cough drops. Or a price for talking class, you have to buy me cough drops. Okay, so if you take initiation, or you have to buy me a mic and a speaker. Then you're going to be naturally engaged. Right? So initiation, naturally, you have to associate with devotees because your guru is a devotee, so you got to at least have that. That devotee. And you're going to be engaged in chanting the holy name and worshiping the deities. And we can see, of course, that Srila Prabhupada really centered his Hare Krishna movement around all five of these, didn't he?
Yeah.
Right? Devotees, deities, dham, hani, nam, bhagavatam. Isn't this kind of like the main things that we do every day in the Hare Krishna movement? Okay, let's go. As time is marching on, we're going to finish this after our next break. And then go on to more stuff on Varnashram. Rupa Goswami seems to really be making this point. All right. So let's go. Let's see what we should do. We've got 7 minutes. Which one should we do for 7 minutes?
I don't know.
Let's do Don. Let's do Don. We'll do the other three after our break. Okay. Can somebody tell me, is there anybody here who lives in either here or anywhere? Okay. Lives in a Don? Okay. Why don't you tell us something about the glories of living in the dham?
You're being ascetic always. You've been charged every day. See that it is like it's new. Now you're going to, so like every day is like.
Whoa! Every day new ecstasy. Someone else here who lives in the dham.
For me, it's like it's so pure because I don't get to associate with the outside world. So it helps me concentrate very nicely.
Okay, so the outside world basically doesn't exist. I think really here in Mayapur you feel that way.
Yeah, right? Yes.
Because we have this walled compound.
But I live outside the compound.
You live outside the compound. It has, yeah, even outside the compound. It's not,
yes,
it's
yes.
Not.
It's all devotees.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny, you know, in one of the Nectar Devotion lectures in 72, Prabhupada was saying in Vrindavan, everyone comes to Vrindavan just for service. No one comes here to make money. And I thought, not anymore. Of course, even when they make money, they have at the, you know, Prabhupada murti shop or the Prabhupada cloth shop. They put some picture of Prabhupada in their shop so you'll buy something from them. But anyway. And yes, Sula, you live in the dham, right? So tell us something about the purifying nature of the dham.
I think somebody already said it, but it's always like it's new and exciting. There's always a festival going on. There's always some way that you get engaged in service.
Wow, always a festival. That's the description of Lord Varaha when he goes back to Vaikuntha. It said Lord Varaha went back to Vaikuntha where every day is a festival. And it's interesting seeing the elephant procession here on Saturday. I remember the only time I've ever been to Sri Rangam. They told me they have like 340 days a year. Would they take the deity on procession? What a place that is. I mean, really, the temple is the center of the whole city. I mean, physically. So you're in a place like that. Okay, someone else who lives in the dham? What can you tell us?
Even the smallest thing can be a devotional service. Like they say, when you sleep, you're paying obeisances.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All the water's gone to the water.
Yeah. A few years ago, when I was here, Jamuna was here. She was very sick. When I went to visit her, she said, "What a great place to be sick." And I'm like, it didn't compute. I thought, when you come to the Dhamma, it's when you don't want to be sick. She said, "I'm lying in bed paying dandavats all the time." You live in the Dhamma too? Well, all of our Dhammavasis are like crowded here in the center.
Everyone said it's a festival there, and most so we get lots of association of devotees, so many coming there, we get to hear from them, and it's more like encouraging and inspiring, and the potency of the Dham is there, because as soon as you step out of the Dham, you're just absorbed in the material world, where you in the Dham, you can focus on your sadhana, do things.
You live here too, right?
Yeah.
Now, tell us something about the glories of the Dham.
Yeah, especially in the nowadays. During the Guru Purnima that day, if you fast in, you take shower in the Ganga, and you can bring all the thousand generation back to Govinda.
Whoa. So you got these thousand times thing, right? You got to free a thousand generations. Or they say any service you do in Vrindavan counts a thousand times. That's one of the things I wrote. He said, some people said it takes a lot of lifetimes to go back to Godhead. He said, but everything you do in the Dham is multiplied by 1,000. You chant one mantra, it's 1,000 mantras. Do we have any other Dhamvasis who didn't say anything? Yes? The cows.
The dogs.
And the dogs.
There's always sadhus coming.
Always sadhus coming in, and everyone who stays here is a sadhu. Okay, it's easy to get in that devotional mood, yeah?
There's something that I heard from Ashana Swami. Once somebody was asking him that they're going to Vrindavan, if he can give some advice. So he says, now when you're going to Vrindavan, you have to think that you are everything's and everybody's servant.
Everything's servant and everybody's servant. Isn't that nice? Yes. Yes.
When we went to Ekachakra earlier this year, Andrea, I've never been, and she was taking us to all the different places. So while we were going, there was these three dogs that always hang around at the temple, and they led the way to every single spot.
They were in front of us, walking in front of us the entire time,
and they stopped at every place that we stopped.
I've heard a number of interesting stories about animals in the Dham. As one of our sannyasis once told me a story about how a parrot in Vrindavan led him to a holy place he was looking for. And one of my friends in Vrindavan also told me how she saw a monkey repeatedly offering dandavats at Rupa Goswami's samadhi. So, of course, we see that sometimes in our temples also with animals. Jananda Swami has compiled the book Animals and Krishna Consciousness. We had an unusual cat in North Carolina who used to come to Mangalartik every day in Bhagavatam class. And it was a vegetarian cat which made him sick and eventually killed him. There's a nice question here on Dham that I thought I would ask if I can find it.
Do you want to tell something?
Oh, yes.
A short thing. During the yatra, Rama Maharaj was telling, this past yatra, he was telling the story of when Lord Chaitanya was giving benedictions to everybody, and Haridasa Thakur just asked to be a dog in the Dham, where you could like, be around the devotees and take the rounds with the devotees. And right when he said it, exactly, right when he said that, a dog was right outside of the pandal. It was crazy. It was like, perfect coincidence. It wasn't a coincidence. And I was like, oh, it seems like maybe that could be Haridasa. It was so.
Okay, so this is a very nice question, and I think we'll end here, and then we'll take a break. One way to perform devotional service is to live in the holy Dham like Vrindavan or Mathura. But then in other places it says you should only stay in the Dham for a short time. Some devotees say that living at the temple is as good as living in the holy Dham. Listen to nectar devotion, is it true? Okay, so we have two different questions here. So we have some instructions that say you should live in the Dham. We have other instructions that say don't live in the Dham. What's your response to that? Yes.
Well, when I was first going to Vrindavan, my dad said not to stay longer because a lot of times if
we have the tendencies to commit offenses, and if you have tendencies to commit offenses, the offenses are, like you said, 1,000 times.
Offenses are also 1,000 times, yes. What I've seen is that it's very easy when you're living in the Dham to sometimes forget you're living in the Dham.
Yes.
And to start taking everything very casually. Familiarity breeds contempt. And to start, you know, losing your respect for the holy places and thinking you're more advanced than you are, or criticizing the local people there, etc., etc. So it's... One of my very good friends at one point thought about living in Radhakund. And she said to me, we have to think, which she ended up deciding not to do. She stayed there for a while. And then she said, just because it's the best place doesn't mean it's the best place for me, and it doesn't mean it's the best place for me now. So really, whether or not we live in the Dham or we just visit depends mostly on what is our
consciousness
and what is
attitude.
Our
intention
and what is our attitude and what is our
nature
and what is our service. So what is my consciousness, my intention, my attitude, and what is my service? I like in the Bhagavatam where Lord Ramachandra sent his brothers out all over the world, and Prabhupada said that the Lord doesn't like his devotees just hanging around him for their own sense gratification. And Prabhupada, of course, left Vrindavan in an old age when people don't like to leave Vrindavan because they're afraid they might die in a minute. They want to die in Vrindavan. He left Vrindavan to go preach in America where he had no friends and no money and no connections and basically no hope of doing anything, because that was his service. That was his service. And I sometimes met devotees who want to stay in Vrindavan even when it's very clear that their service is calling them elsewhere. And, you know, I've said to them, look, we are servants. We are servants. And we go where our master tells us to go. And we should be carrying the Dham in our mind and in our heart. So that's, as to whether you visit or whether you stay, it depends on your consciousness, your intention, your motives. And it depends on what is your service. Depends on what is your service. We are servants. And I don't have the time to tell the story, but I had a very strong indication about 6 years ago that my service lies mostly in preaching, not just sitting in the Dham and chanting. Although I like to do that, that's not the service Krishna wants me to do right now. So it's, you know, what is your service? It happened again this year, actually. I had planned a whole thing that I was going to do in Govardhan, and Krishna had some other plans for me. So, you know, you have to see, what is my service? What is my service? Because, again, it's got to be anukulyena. It's got to be, my intention has to be to please Krishna. It can't be that my intention is for my own liberation and my own purification. My intention has to be to please Krishna. And if Krishna wants me to be here, if Krishna wants me to be there, ultimately it comes down to that. But it's also my consciousness. I may see that maybe Krishna would like it if I could stay in the Dham, but I'm just not ready for it yet. And so he's saying, you know, okay, you better... So maybe Krishna is saying, don't live in the Dham because we're not ready and we're going to commit offenses. And maybe we are ready and we wouldn't commit offenses, but maybe we're not staying in the Dham because Krishna has business for us elsewhere, like Srila Prabhupada. And maybe a combination. You know, and I know people who lived in the Dham for 20 years and now, you know, they have business elsewhere. People like, say, Burujan Prabhu or Ananda Vrindavaneshwari and Vrajabihari. And then the other question is living in the temple as good as living in the holy Dham? I don't have a Shastric reference for this, but this is something one devotee said, and I thought it was a good analogy. And he said that the Dhams are like high ground, and the temples and other holy places are like low ground with a wall around it. That the Dhams are permanent holy places, and other places are temporarily established holy places. That as soon as you take down the wall, they can get flooded. And I thought that was a good analogy. And that really sort of hits with my experience. So the Dhams are always a Dham. When Gopal Kumar came back to the material world, he said that everything in the material world had changed except for the Dham. Because these are not actually part of the material world. You know, when Markandeya Rishi saw the destruction of the world, he was right across the Jalangi at Surabhikunj. And that this area didn't get destroyed in the destruction. It's not really part of the material world. Whereas if you just make a temple in, you know, wherever, that's not going to be true of that place. And Prabhupada compares the temples to embassies. So you've got, you know, the actual country, and then you've got the embassy. And the embassy, legally, is that country. If you have a Russian embassy in India, then when as soon as you go in the embassy, you're in Russian territory. But if that embassy closes or moves, then it immediately reverts to being Indian territory. It's not solidly Russian territory. So I thought that was a good example. And not only the temple, but what about even a little place in your house, in your room? We make a sacred space. I remember one sannyasi who visited our gurukula and saw the... I was living in one of the rooms of the school and saw my little altar, and he says, "Oh, you're a Brijvasi." Because, you know, there was Govardhan and Radhakrishna, and later on I had a setup with Radhakrishna, Govardhan, and Tulsi, and there in the house. And I visited devotees' homes, one in particular I can think of. I visited devotees' homes where you walk in the temple room and you immediately feel, whoa, I've entered into a sacred space. I've entered into another dimension. So ultimately, we should be carrying the Dham in our heart. And we are carrying the Dham in our heart. If Krishna is in our heart, then guess what? Every place, you know, every place is there. Krishna's there, then Vrindavan is there, and Navadvipa is there, and Dwarka, and every place is there in our heart. We don't really need to go any place with our body. So ultimately, we want to carry the holy place in our heart. And Prabhupada said chanting in the temple has a thousand times the potency of chanting outside the temple. So that's that idea that the temple is also the Dham. In Hungary, some of you may know, Shivaramar has established a new Vraj Dham, like Prabhupada wanted a new Vrindavan. And what he did was he went around the property and said, okay, here's Govardhan Hill, here's Radhakund, here's the Yamuna, here's Keshigat. And he established all around the property, and every building in the property is designated as some place. So this, you know, you stay in this house, this is Rupa Goswami Samadhi, you stay in this house, it's this place. And it's lovely. I was there the first year that he took a parkrun of the property before Janmashtami. It was a 3-day parkrun, and we'd stop at each place, and he would tell us, this is the place. For some places he just had flags, for some places they've made a little like structure. And for the first 2 days, I was thinking, oh, come on, this is Hungary. Yeah, you know, whatever. This is in Vrindavan. We're in Hungary. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, whatever. This is Hungary. And the third day, I don't know when it happened, but some point during the third day, I don't know, it wasn't Hungary anymore. And I was like, wow, we actually are in the Dham. And his point was, Radhasham is here. If Radhasham is here, then Vrindavan has to be here. How are Radhasham going to be here without Vrindavan here? He's recently published a 9-volume book explaining each place in his farm as related to the place in Vrindavan and what leelas went on there. There's also a farm in Ireland like that on Innisfruith. And it was really lovely when I was there. As you go through, they haven't done it to the same extent, but as you go through the property, you'll see a sign, you know, this is where Deinakasura was killed, and you look in the tree, and there he is. Really, seriously, there's this stuffed donkey in the tree. and it's quite nice. At the Bhaktivedanta Manor, they only do it for Janmashtami, but on Janmashtami, they transform the woods that goes around the property, around the pond, into the Vrindavan forest. And as you get... The things you should do in your life, make sure you go to the Bhaktivedanta Manor for Janmashtami at least once in your life. But you go through the forest, and there's all different leelas. That they have these huge paintings, like bigger than life-size paintings, put on wood that they've cut out. And then they set up... like Krishna and the Coward Boys eating, and they have these baskets with plastic fruit and things like that. And then they have devotees that go the whole festival. They get about 100,000 people to come. They have a devotee that goes to the whole festival spraying perfume. So the whole thing's perfumed. And then they have archways with, unfortunately not real flowers, it's not Indian, but archways with covered with plastic flowers. And then as you come to each section, there's a recording that plays about the Leela. And this is as you go, this is the Darshan line to see the deities, and you go through the Vrindavan forest, and different, and they have a pond, and they have different leelas every year. So one time it's the boat pastime with Krishna and the gopis, one time it's Krishna dancing on Kalia, one time it's Vasudeva carrying Krishna across the Jamuna, and you look in the water, and there's Vasudeva, and there's Krishna, you know, and there's music, and there's recordings, and there's perfume, and sometimes they have all other kinds of special effects, and you really feel like there you are in Krishna's Leela. And it must have been 1976 in New York, Prabhupada came for our first Rath Yatra. We had a theater group there. Unfortunately, most of the members of that theater group are no longer in this body. But Lokamangala, who's not living anymore, was Ravana. Loitaksha, who's not living anymore, was Ram. And his wife, Vasagyal, who's not living anymore, was Sita. So I was sitting just a couple rows behind Srila Prabhupada, and we were watching the scene where Ravana has kidnapped Sita, and he's carrying her, and Jatayu, the vulture, comes to save Sita. And he prepares to fight with Ravana, and Sita says, "No, you're too old, and Ravana is so much stronger than you." And somehow at that moment, New York disappeared, and the theater disappeared, and there we were in the Dandaka forest with actually Sita and Jatayu and Ravana. So that's, and sometimes that can happen, you know, we're going to go to Bhagavatam. That can happen also in a Bhagavatam class. So I had the experience in Italy at our scholars conference. So first or second day, Radhika Raman gave the Bhagavatam class, and hardly anybody came. He's not a sannyasi, he's just a gurukuli, and he was only in his 20s. And so it wasn't a very full temple room, and nobody recorded the class because he wasn't a big devotee. But Krishna manifested in that Bhagavatam class. It really felt like Krishna was walking through the temple room and manifesting his leelas. I don't know if you ever met Radhika Raman, but his mother homeschooled him just from Bhagavatam. She created her own curriculum just from Bhagavatam. And he became, actually Prabhupada said that our children just by studying the Bhagavatam will be more than PhDs. And that's actually what happened to him. By the time he was 12, he was admitted into the local university. That's also like the honorary degree. First, he was just auditing classes, and then the professor says, really, he should be enrolled. And finally, they actually admitted him to the college at age 12 or 13. He ended up getting his PhD from Oxford at the age of 22, doing his thesis on Jiva Goswami. And he's now a professor in America. And he gave a presentation at one seminar I went to on Jiva Goswami, and many sannyasis were attending, and it was, what a person. He was exemplified a devotee, a gentleman, you know, perfect Sanskrit. He can speak, because he was raised in America, he can speak perfect English, because his parents are Indian, he can speak perfect Hindi and perfect Sanskrit. And, you know, he just knew the Shastra in and out, but completely humble. But anyway, the spiritual world definitely manifested when he was giving Bhagavatam class. It was on a section of Krishna's pastimes out of Vrindavan, and he was telling different stories of Krishna's pastimes. And as he was telling this, everybody in the class was just... So being in the Dham, of course, being in the Dham is still being in the Dham. We're not going to say that because the Dham's in your temple and the Dham's in your heart and the Dham's in your temple room and the Dham can manifest in the Bhagavatam that you should never actually physically take your body and move it to the Dham. But still, the Dham can manifest in many ways. Let's just take a 10-minute break. So that'll be till 12:38.